Doughty, a shot, save, rebound, cleared away. Held in up high, Doughty. To the left circle to Kovalchuk. Moves to his right. Feeds it right circle to Kopitar. Kopitar cross ice. Doughty a shot. He scores!
You're listening to All the Kings Men, the official podcast of the LA Kings. Now, here's your host, Jesse Cohen.
Welcome back, Kings fans. My name is Jesse Cohen. This is All the Kings Men. With the rain playing Friday night, then back-to-back Kings games on the weekend, we're going to have another burst of episodes for you. But next week, we will fall into a more stable release schedule. We've got a bit of a hodgepodge episode for you today. First up, Scott Wheeler from The Athletic talks about his article on Arthur Kaliev. Then I spent about 10 minutes with Rasmus Kupari. And finally, Kat Silverman joined me as we attempted an autopsy on the 14 goals Jonathan Quick gave up on the opening road trip. Spoiler alert. Even Kat concedes they weren't all his fault. Times and segment lengths listed in the episode notes. Here we go. Joining me now from The Athletic, Scott Wheeler. How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm excellent. It seems like every time we speak, we're talking about prospects, and you wrote an article, and the headline caught my eye. The headline was, "He'll be one of the best players in the world. Kings prospect Arthur Kaliev is more than just a goal scorer." Best player in the world is it's a strong phrase.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, that was his coach speaking, his coach in Hamilton, Vince Lays. And I spent some time with Arthur over the course of a day late last week and ultimately wrote a story on him. And he's always fascinated me. I was really high on him in his draft year. I had him in my top 15 on my end of season draft ranking. And ultimately, I think that when he slipped and slipped as far as he did, that he became a potential steal for the Kings. So I kind of wanted to investigate that hypothesis by actually talking to the people that deal with him. So I spoke with his strength and conditioning coach, and I spoke with his coach, and I spoke with him and the general manager of the Hamilton Bulldogs, Steve Steos. And ultimately, the picture that I got of him was that this kid is a world-class talent. And sure, there are some issues that resulted in him slipping. His skating isn't the strongest stride in the world. His work ethic at times is can be a little bit of an issue. He can blow by pucks and try to flee the zone a little bit too early in the defensive zone, and that can sort of burn him, and he can get caught, et cetera, et cetera. But what Vince said was ultimately that this kid is so talented, not just as a goal scorer, which everyone seems to sort of label him as this one-dimensional scorer, but also as a playmaker and a puck carrier and someone who can protect the puck and someone who can create for his line mates and execute high-end passes and all of those things. He's kind of the full package offensively, and he's also gotten a lot stronger according to his strength and conditioning coach. So ultimately what I was left with was kind of a reconfirmation of where I stood on him and the belief that he has the talent to be a world-class player. And his talent level, I mean, you don't score, I touch on it in the article, but and so do his coaches, but you don't score 100 points as a 17-year-old or 50 goals as a 17-year-old unless you're really an elite, elite talent who's kind of a once every 5 or 10 years for some of these junior clubs kind of player.
Yeah, a lot is made of the 51 goals he scored, and you know, you list the four players in recent history that have done the same. I think it was DeBrincat, and I'm blanking on the other three names at the moment, but
Marner, McDavid, DeBrincat, and Strom.
Yeah, it's a pretty good list. But what doesn't get talked about, or if it does, it gets talked about sort of in the way that you just mentioned, which is that he scored 102 points, which means he also collected 51 assists. Mm-hmm. Not that scoring assists is necessarily any kind of indicator of work ethic. You know, you can pick up a secondary assist here or there, or somebody can, you know, whack in a rebound on a shot you took. But I mean, he is a good playmaker, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the gap that he built was a gap that he had built over other people who were quote unquote playmakers. I mean, he had 27 more points than Ryan Suzuki, who was the only player in his age group who came even close to him in terms of production. And that's a 27 point gap over a 68 game season is pretty significant. And people talk about Ryan Suzuki as this brilliant playmaker, and he is an excellent playmaker and was a first round pick because of his ability to pass. But 50 assists, and Arthur Kaliev had 51. So it's not like Ryan Suzuki was blowing him out of the water. And ultimately, I think Kaliev and his coaches and Steos and everybody kind of reasserted this, but Kaliev is an excellent playmaker. He is a dynamic passer, and when he draws a lot of attention because of his shot, and particularly his one-timer, that opens up the rest of the ice, and that opens up his teammates, and he has learned over the years to really take advantage of that and to really use that as a sort of second layer of skill. So I think that for me is what stands out about him, and he's not just a goal scorer. He's a hell of a lot more than that, and he's continued to prove that this season. He started the season generating a ton of assists in Hamilton this year, and it wasn't really the goal scoring. He was generating a ton of shots, but they weren't falling for him, and ultimately he had to rely on that goal scoring. So there's just a ton of to like about Arthur.
If I'm not mistaken, he currently has 11 points on 4 goals and 7 assists through 7 games so far this season. And last season, we mentioned he had 102 points. The next highest scorer on his team was Matthew Strome with 79 points. Brandon Sagan, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, had 63 points, but it was in 40 games, so that's fairly impressive. And then you drop down to 51 points, 34 points, 30 points. I mean, he was the dominant point producer on his team, and there was a season, I don't remember, maybe 10 years ago or something, where Teemu Selanne had something like a hand in 61% of Ducks' goals scored or something. That might have been the year after Kariya left. I can't remember, but it was some absurdly high number. Now, I have seen speculation, and I grant you it's from message boards, but speculation that because he is so vital to the Hamilton Bulldogs offense, that he might be playing a high number of minutes. And so this notion that he has a lazy work ethic or isn't a great skater or whatever, part of that might be because he's simply pacing himself. Did you get any sense of that or any sense that the team relies so heavily on him that evaluating his talent might be more difficult?
I mean, there's certainly a sort of do-it-yourself mentality that he has to have in a situation like the one that he's in Hamilton, more so this season than last season, because players like Sagan and Strome are gone now, and the team is really his. I wouldn't be surprised in the least if the Bulldogs rebuild midseason this year because they struggle, and that means that he's dealt to a contending team at the OHL trade deadline. But until then, he's going to have to do it himself, and certainly that creates a mentality where he tries to do too much with the puck. I wouldn't necessarily say that translates in a serious way to his commitment on defensive plays. I mean, the game that I watched last Friday ahead of finishing up this story, I went to Mississauga to see him play the Steelheads, and there were a number of plays that were just sort of flat out lazy, and he obviously scored in the game and created more offense than anybody on either team in the game, and he had missed the net narrowly on a few shots. Like, he could have had 3 or 4 goals that night. But at the same time, there are certainly plays that you can't just chalk up to the fact that he's trying to do too much or that he's relied upon too heavily, that kind of thing. So I think it's a bit of a mixed bag, but you definitely have to consider the fact that his team isn't very good, particularly this year offensively, and he's going to be relied on and he's going to have to kind of pull some rabbits out of his hat. So that's going to play out consistently more this year than last year, and it will probably impact his production.
What did you make of his performance at the World Junior Summer Showcase?
Oh, he was great. I went to Plymouth this year for the World Junior Summer Showcase. I watched almost the entirety of the tournament. I was there for, I believe, 4 out of his 5 games, and he was just outstanding. I mean, he looked like a dominant player, and he was one of the players that by the end of the tournament really had caught the eye of head coach Scott Sandelin and of John Van Biesbroek, who runs the program there. And I included some of their commentary in the story about Kaliev. And there's just a lot to like about the way that he played there. He was a huge threat, really, and consistently scoring and generating chances shift to shift. And he looked excellent on the flank of Trevor Zegras, who was kind of the playmaker at the program last year and is kind of one of the better passers in last year's draft. So that could be a really good, if he makes the team and if they kind of reunite Zegras and Kaliev, I could see them being a really dynamic offensive line for Team USA at this year's World Juniors in Ostrava.
You mentioned in the article that he's incredibly well-liked by his teammates. This is a terrible way to judge someone's personality. But anytime he's filming one of those rookie, intro packages where they have the lights in the background and the cameras moving in and anything, or anytime, I've seen a couple of the Fox Sports West and the Kings, promo pieces for him, he's got sort of an awkward smile, and maybe he's not super like camera ready, to use a sort of goofy Hollywood term. But I mean, he is, it sounds from your article like he has a really great personality and is quote unquote good in the room.
Yeah, that was also something that kind of surprised me when I was doing this story, just because he's got a reputation through the combine interviews of being someone who kind of struggled in conversation, and he still has a thick Russian accent, even though he represents Team USA, and his English isn't the greatest in the world. And yeah, he doesn't come across with a lot of the ease that you expect out of some of these players, especially the players who are really talented and are often borderline cocky and overconfident when they're dealing with the media and that kind of a thing. So he's certainly a little shy and soft-spoken, but according to Hamilton's staff and his teammates that I spoke to, he is kind of completely the opposite once the cameras are off and he's sort of with the guys in the room and on the bus. And apparently he's quite the jokester and quite the prankster and a really sort of vivacious personality who is captivating and draws people to him, and one of the favorites of all of his teammates on the team. So he's not shy by any means in sort of his more comfortable spaces, which seems to be at the rink, and that bodes really well. So I think that was a key takeaway for me, just because he did take some criticism ahead of the draft last year for the way that he interviewed and how uncomfortable he seemed to be, and that's obviously not the case when he's around sort of people his own age and teammates and that kind of a thing.
I'm curious if the interview process ever finds its way out of professional sports. I've always felt like it was sort of an odd thing to do, since sitting in an interview room surrounded by executives has really little parallel to what you might experience in a professional sports setting. And I just know from my own personal experience, I can have a conversation with somebody and it's free flowing and it's comfortable and it's great and they're engaging. And then as soon as I ask them to put the headphones on and turn the mics on, the answers, get cut in half. There's a lot of ums and ahs, yep, and nervousness, and people get super self-conscious, and it's never necessarily an indicator of anything else.
Yeah, I think certainly the process is always going to exist. I think teams would be silly not to do the most possible due diligence. But I think what has happened and what should continue to happen is that those interview processes shouldn't hold the weight that they maybe once did. I think teams now recognize more and more that it's just a chance to get to know the player, and it shouldn't be held with any serious sort of weight to it. And ultimately, I think that it's a very tough situation to put a 17-year-old kid into. And it's a very challenging situation, and they do dozens of interviews. Some players interview with almost every single team. You talk to kids at the draft and they'll have interviewed with 29 or 30 teams over a 48-hour span. So they're basically bouncing from interview to interview and answering the same questions over and over again. And it can be nerve-wracking for them, and they're in a high stress situation. So I think teams need to do a good job of recognizing that. And there are certainly teams that put too much emphasis on the interview process. Yeah, I remember talking to teams about Matt Barzell's interview process, and the only reason that Matt Barzell fell to the New York Islanders and fell out of the top 10 in his draft was because teams felt like he was too cocky in his interviews, and he didn't interview well, and it became a real talking point ahead of the draft. And ultimately, Matt Barzell's cockiness is what makes Matt Barzell Matt Barzell, and now he's one of the best players in the world, and all of those teams are or should be sort of really regretting passing on him. So, it's a process that's a little weird for me. And I think teams need to increasingly every year sort of put less and less weight in them, because it's not a true way to really get to know a kid.
This is a horrible alleyway to go down, but did you ever see the Kevin Costner film Draft Day?
I did not.
All right. Well, anyway, it's about a general manager of a football team, and they're debating whether or not they should take this, blue chip quarterback. And at one point he finds out that nobody from his team went to his birthday party or something like that. And I just feel like that's not that you should you know, put all sorts of stock into something like that. But to me, that's just as instructive as whether or not a guy is any good at an interview. You can coach people to be good at interviews, and some people just won't ever be good at them. Anyway, I want to focus on the last two sentences of the piece, because I think ultimately it's going to play a much bigger role than anything we've talked about. You say, he asked if he had a chip on his shoulder. Kaliev chuckled. Yeah, he said with a smile. He did drop out of the first round into the second round. It was somewhat of a story. Did you get the sense that he's eager to prove all those people wrong?
Totally. I think it definitely motivated him. He said that he doesn't care about it and that he's just happy to be an LA King, and kind of said what every young player says about getting drafted. But he also hinted that it doesn't matter where you get drafted, and I'm going to show them once I'm in the NHL that people made a mistake on me and that I'm better than that, and et cetera, et cetera. And everyone's going to forget about where I was drafted once they see me play in the NHL, kind of thing. So he definitely has a sort of quiet confidence to him and a quiet swagger to him. And I'm sure it's a little bit louder when he's among his teammates, but that really spoke to me, because I think that, and every player certainly, depending on where they were drafted, has the right to be a little disappointed. But him in particular, just because of the conversation around him last year and how toxic it was, and I would imagine that his interview processes, he was challenged a lot by teams about his work ethic and his defensive play and his skating and all of that. And it naturally, given how productive he was, he probably felt like he deserved to go a lot higher. He probably was disappointed on that Friday night at the draft in Vancouver when it was over, and he had to go back to his hotel, and he still hadn't been selected, and he probably didn't sleep all that well that night, just waiting and wondering how long he was going to have to wait on day two. And ultimately, the Kings didn't really waste any time with him, but I would imagine that he is hell-bent to prove people wrong, and that he's got a good decent odds at doing that given his skill level.
Well, from your lips to the hockey gods' ears, Scott, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Yep, cheers, no sweat.
And if anybody still doesn't have a subscription to The Athletic, Scott is an excellent reason why you should go ahead and do that.
I appreciate that.
That was Scott Wheeler, all the way from Canada, on the Foster Hewitt Memorial Hotline. Now, here's my chat with Rasmus Kupari from earlier this week when he joined me in the Sean Backman podcast studio in sunny El Segundo. Rasmus, first off, I want to say congratulations on your first goal in the AHL.
Thank you.
How did it feel?
Yeah, it was a great feel. Of course, nice to score a goal. And in the first game, it's important to got things going, and I think it takes a couple of games to get used to small rink and AHL, NHL. It's, of course, it's a little bit different game style and that kind of stuff here than back in Europe and Finland. But yeah, great feeling to be here and got games started last week.
The fans are obviously familiar with you, and a lot of fans have been looking forward to seeing you play. But this is your first opportunity to see the fans up close and personal. What did you think about the fans in Ontario and the response they gave on that 5-0 opening game?
Yeah, it was like great opening ceremony and good fans out there. Yeah, excited to play there more games and win games, score some goals.
Could you feel the fire off of that opening ceremony, the two big things, you know, shooting flames up into the air?
Yeah, that was like, actually we had back home those kind of flames before every
home. At Carpot?
Yeah.
Really?
Before every home game. But yeah, it's especially nice for the fans, get those kind of things and effects.
So you look perfectly at home on the ice. How are you adapting off the ice? How is Southern California? Have you figured out LA yet?
Yeah, a little bit. Of course, it's a different world than back home. But yeah, I get used to it all the time, better and better. And here's so many places to visit, and weather, it's so warm all the time. Sun is shining every day. And yeah, of course, it's a little bit expensive to live here than back home, but yeah, I just need to work hard every day and to get place in the NHL someday. But yeah, I like it to be here.
You grew up in Kotka, correct?
Yeah.
Which is on the coast.
Yeah.
Does LA feel at least a little bit comfortable because of the water and, the, and that?
Yeah, like a little bit, especially summer times. It's nice to be there back in home. Kotka, it's just on the ocean and it's warm a couple of months there. So, yeah, it's nice to have water here too.
And you're one of the younger players in the franchise and certainly on the team, but there's a lot of younger players coming into the Reign this year. Have you guys all begun bonding together? Do you have a nickname yet? Do you get along with anybody in particular on the team?
It's nice to have like younger players too. Like, of course, it's a little bit different to first time meet a younger player than older player and talk with them. But yeah, a couple guys are like guys I knew before. A couple of guys are new faces. But yeah, I think it's good group there, and we're practicing hard, and a couple games have went pretty good. So
in North America, the tradition for nicknames is to put the put an E at the end of everybody's Brownie, you know, Kobe, Dewey, all that. But your last name, you know, already has that sound at the end of it, Kupari. Any nicknames that people have given you yet?
Like people are calling me just Raz or Coop. So not
Coop's either. A good solid American nickname. What's your favorite cultural thing about Southern California compared to Finland so far? Any restaurants you really like? Any music that you're enjoying?
Hard to say yet, but yeah, there's so many restaurants. It's sometimes hard to choose one where you go. Yeah, hard to say yet, but just nice to be here. And now I have a place where to live and a car, so it helps.
What are you driving?
I have a Mercedes.
Very nice.
Yeah, but yeah, of course that helps to live here. And mm-hmm. Now I just need to focus on hockey and work hard every day.
What are the expectations that the coaching staff and the hockey development staff have expressed to you as far as your first year? Have they told you, you know, don't worry about trying to reach the NHL right away, try and develop your game? Or are they focusing on any specific aspect of the game?
Yeah, those kind of stuff you said, but also some smaller things than like defense play. That's maybe I'm playing centerman, so that's maybe biggest thing I need to maybe focus more and improve. But yeah, just work hard every day and try to develop as much you can. But yeah, things are going.
Do you like center or do you prefer wing?
I maybe like more center. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I can play as a winger too. But past 2-3 years, I'm mostly played as a centerman all the time.
I was at the game, the home opener 5-0 game, and there were at least 3 passes that I saw you make where it was either through a defender's legs or through tight coverage or just really impressive. I wouldn't have even seen that as an option to complete the pass, but you pulled it off. Are you finding it challenging making plays like that on a smaller ice rink against bigger players, or is that... Or do you? I mean, you looked comfortable.
Yeah, I think smaller rink chances are coming like faster. I think I just need to be ready all the time to make some smart play. And that game, there was good chances to just pass to line mate. I remember one chance I passed to Mario. What he said, through the their defense man through his legs. So, yeah.
How does the level of play compare from Carpot to Ontario and the AHL to Liga?
Of course, I think game is a little bit maybe faster. We're going, how you say it, like all time up and down. There in Liga, it's maybe a little more like we're focusing more to game system, and we are trying to like first defense as good we can, and it's like a not that faster game. Like all teams are very good defense, but here in first game I saw there's like small rink does it that here's more chances than there, and game is a little bit faster, and you need to be ready all the time to go forward and backward.
Had you ever been to Bakersfield before?
No, that was my first time.
Any first impressions of Bakersfield?
not much, but no. Yeah, it was like a tight game.
Yeah, but you pulled it out. You're up 2-0. Thank you very much for Thank you very much for joining us, and good luck with the rest of your season.
No problem. Thanks.
Big thanks to Rasmus Kupari for that conversation. Now comes the part of the podcast that's not going to be so much fun. Cat Silverman is here to answer the question that tons of Kings fans were asking me and each other. What happened in that 8-2 loss to Vancouver? Joining me now for the first time in a long time, my personal goalie guru, Cat Silverman. How are you doing today, Cat?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm excellent. Now, you and I have disagreed in the past about whether or not John Quick is hashtag elite. You know that I think he is. I know that you think he's not. And generally speaking, my personal philosophy is not to get into the weeds on blaming goalies for specific goals. I don't think it's terribly instructive for your average fan. Most of the time, if you see a goal and it's your team scoring it, you just go, oh, attaboy, that's Kopi, that's, you know, that's Drew. Nothing they could do to stop that one. And if it's your goalie, everybody just wants to pile on him. Unfortunately, we find ourselves in a position where Jonathan Quick has allowed 14 goals in 2 games. And a lot of that could be chalked up to a young defensive core. I shouldn't say young, but inexperienced defensive core. Ben Hutton is new. Toby Bjornfoot is an 18-year-old rookie. Walker and Roy are relatively young in their career. And Drew Doughty is obviously Drew Doughty. But for the first 2 games of the season, I do want to kind of get in the weeds, and that's why I've brought you here, Kat.
Yeah, this is going to be a...
It's not going to be fun. No.
I was going to say fun. Fun's maybe not the right word for this. It's whether I think that Jonathan Quick is elite per se or not, it's never fun watching a goaltender give up 14 goals in 2 games. It's been kind of hard to watch.
Particularly sure one as accomplished as Jonathan Quick.
Exactly. One who very clearly loves winning and loves representing his team in a positive way, which, based on the stat lines right now, is not what he has been able to do through the first 2 games, and so I'm sure he's as frustrated as we are.
Now, it is a small sample size, and there are, I don't know if they're...
It's a large goal
size. Yeah, all right, calm down. so let's start with the Edmonton game. We're not going to go through goal by goal. I want to start off by saying, from my perspective, that first minute fluke goal, that's one of those cases where, like I said, I'm not interested in assigning blame. It's the first minute. It's Connor McDavid. It trickles in, bounces off a guy's foot. Like, that's just one of those.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested in placing blame on that one, but not on Quick. I'm kind of interested in placing blame on his teammate, because that's the second goal. Or I guess that would be the first of two. That's the first of 2 goals that his own teammates have kicked in of those 14. So we can scrap 2 of them. That's still 12 goals in 2 games, but
sure,
but it's 14.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm just not like, there's always, every year there's going to be a handful of goals where you just have to shrug and say, okay, what are you going to do, right? And a first minute goal in the first game after the team's been off for 8 days, it bounces off of Roy's foot. Anyway, we're not going to get into that one.
what's your quick summary of the Edmonton game for the other five goals?
It's kind of funny because obviously the Oilers are an offensively gifted team. They may not be a cohesively gifted team. They may have a goaltender who likes to allow empty net goals, which Quick didn't allow any of those. So, like, that's nice. But there's no reason that an NHL team should have been allowing as many cross-ice passes in the slot as the Kings were allowing from Edmonton. And
yeah.
Some of those goals were very much Jonathan Quick's fault. I think both of the James Neal goals were Jonathan Quick's fault. I believe that was the second and maybe the final goal.
Yeah, the second and the sixth.
Yeah, and both of those, I think the first of those two, the second goal, Jonathan Quick makes the initial stop. It's not his fault that the team has allowed James Neal to sit directly on his front doorstep, but he doesn't seem to know where his rebound went.
Yeah.
He looks to the right. The puck has bounced slightly to the left. He starts lifting his pads off the ice, and all that James Neal has to do is tuck it underneath him. I think a peewee could do that. And then you kind of see the same thing on the final one. That's another one where, once again, James Neal had no business being that close to Jonathan Quick. That's on the defense. But once again, Jonathan Quick just didn't seem like he knew what was going on directly in front of him, and that's kind of on him. But the rest of them, if we're talking about the Jonathan Quick who won two Stanley Cups, yeah, he has to stop all those, because a cross-ice pass happens during every NHL game. You have to be able to stop a shot off of a cross-ice pass. But they're hard, and they're all happening in the low slot there. And mm-hmm. That's something that, you know, if your goaltender's not at the very top of his game, of course he's going to allow that goal. So if Quick's a little rusty, if he's frustrated, if he's tired both, like, physically and emotionally of what's going on with this team, it's understandable that he's allowing these goals, because they're high-quality shots. It's not like he's allowing a bunch of stinkers, although he did allow one that I believe in the game against Vancouver that was like a point blank shot.
Yeah, we'll get to that one.
but no, most of those ones by Edmonton were high quality shots that he was allowing, and it's concerning that the team allowed essentially six high quality chances in that game. It's just also unfortunate that all six of them were allowed to go in, which,
yeah, that's the part.
I think,
though,
that's really what sums it up.
but that's the part where I'm willing to say, listen, I'm not going to blame a two-time Stanley Cup champion, one-time Conn Smythe winner, and Olympian for getting a little bit older and a little bit slower. So there's one goal against Edmonton where Roy gets beaten badly on the outside as his man crosses the blue line, and he sends a wide-open uncontested pass to the goal scorer. I'm blanking on which goal it was, but Adrian Kempe is, you know, covering that man, and he puts sort of a half-hearted effort into disrupting the guy's shot, and so he winds up with a wide open shot from the hash marks in the slot, completely uncontested with speed. And that's where I say, like, okay, maybe Jonathan Quick at the peak of his powers stops that one, but I'm simply not going to blame him for an uncontested shot in between the hash marks on a rush, right? Like, that's just, you know, if that pass had been from Kopitar to Brown and Brown had buried it, we wouldn't be spending any time thinking about whether or not the other goalie, we as Kings fans, you might, because you're a goalie analyst, but Kings fans wouldn't have spent any time critiquing the goaltending. We'd just say, like, amazing pass, amazing shot, and we'd move on with our life.
Right.
So let's move to the Vancouver game, because that's the most recent one. It's the eight goals. It's the one where people are wondering why not pull Jonathan Quick at some point. Now, Jack Campbell had played the night before, so from your perspective as a goalie coach, analyst, and as a goalie, before we get into breaking down the goals, do you think leaving Quick in was the right decision from the coach's standpoint?
I think it entirely depends on whether or not they asked him. I know that we saw last year, ironically enough, it was games, I believe, 80 and 81 for the Kings, and then for the game 81 for the Arizona Coyotes, where Jonathan Quick played the game the first night, allowed something like seven goals, got pulled with 11 minutes to go. Jack Campbell finished the game, and then he played the subsequent night against the Coyotes and got shelled with like something like 35 shots in the first 20 minutes of the game and managed to survive. He actually is the reason that the Coyotes got eliminated from the playoffs last year, but that's a really hard thing to do to your goalie consistently. And I think that if they want Jack Campbell to be the reason they win any games this year, they do have to ask Jonathan Quick every once in a while when he has games like these where he allows, you know, 8 goals, they have to say, hey, are you willing to just see this one through? Because Jack played last night and we're going to need him to be healthy for the next game and we're going to need him to play the Lions share the starts this year. Are you willing to stay in for the rest of the game? And if Jonathan Quick cares about Jack Campbell, which everything we've seen from him suggests that he does, you know, he's a fantastic teammate and a fantastic goalie partner. I think he probably says, yes, leave me in for the rest of this game. We're probably not winning it anyway. We're down, you know, 6-2, whatever it is at that point. Just leave me in for the rest of it. If we lose 8-2 instead of 6-2, that does nothing to our position in the standings.
Right.
But it gives Jack Campbell a little bit of rest and kind of like what happens with Josh Rosen and the Miami Dolphins. Your young up-and-comer gains no additional benefit by being put into a game behind teammates who are fatigued and no longer care about the game.
As a fan, just purely as a fan, at about, I think it was the 6th goal, because I think 5 and 6 came in rapid succession. And at that point, I think they had been up 4-2, and I was like, maybe they're climbing back in this, and all of a sudden, bang, bang, game's over, and there's still plenty of time left in the game. I mean, an absurd amount of time left in the game. From a fan perspective, I was, you know, I was thinking, oh my God, get him out of there. What are you doing? What are you doing? And then I saw your tweet and a few others about, you know, no, let, you know, Campbell just played the last night. What are you thinking? You don't toss him in there just to get, you know, just to get bombarded with, like you said, more high quality shots. So let's go through, them. Quinn Hughes' first goal. I'm inclined to think that that was just a really nice shot.
Yeah, that was a really good angle shot. My exact note, because I went through each of these goals and wrote a sentence or two, is good angle, not a ton he could have done.
Yeah, I mean, so, every now and then you just have to concede that the other team is good, right? Like,
right.
No goalie finishes the whole year without allowing one. The Sutter goal, less good.
Yeah, that one, once again. And the common theme here is going to be bad defense allowed the Canucks to all but walk into the slot. Bad defense is going to allow the other team to walk into the slot this year. That's just what they're doing. But Quick just got beaten point blank. That was a pass to center ice and he was just beaten. And that's one of those things where I don't know if he's not tracking correctly. I don't know if he's not moving as well as he used to. I don't know if he's trying to calm his movements down a bit to compensate for age, and that's throwing off his timing. You know, that's one of those things where it's irresponsible for me to assert anything based on my speculations, but something is not looking correct there when shots like that are coming at Jonathan Quick, and that was one of them.
And so it's early in the period now, it's 2-0, and then they make it 3-0. What do we think of goal number 3?
That one I'm kind of torn on, because Elias Pettersson, he's so good, yeah, even when he doesn't have time or space, and he had neither there. He got a pass when he was directly in front of the goal, but that's the kind of shot that you expect Quick to stop that one, because it's a cross-ice pass that finds its way over. But one of the things that made Jonathan Quick so good and so effective for so long is that extra pad extension that he manages to get. He has such good core stability that he's able to reach his pad out and get those little deflections. And he didn't. And that was, watching that goal, I was surprised, because that's the kind of goal that you expect a Martin Jones or even a Corey Crawford to allow that goal. Well, you allow Martin Jones to allow a lot of goals, but that's one of those where, just based on Jonathan Quick's strengths, you expect him to stop that one. And so I was kind of surprised, not that he was getting beaten by a high quality shot, but that he was getting beaten by that kind of shot, and didn't love it.
You referenced earlier, though, that there may be, and as you said, it's irresponsible to to try and put ourselves in the heads of specific players. But I would be comfortable if you said that there were certain players in the league, and Quick maybe one of them, who realized that risking personal injury to give peak performance in game three of a season where you're restructuring and recreating your team maybe isn't worth it. Not only from a personal perspective, but from the team's perspective. You know, if Jonathan Quick gets hurt in game three, killing himself trying to make a save on a cross-crease pass, it doesn't do the Kings any better than it does Jonathan Quick. And I realize I'm making excuses, but...
it's kind of a catch-22 because it's kind of an excuse for him. But it's also, if you're... At what point in the season, then, do we expect him to play to his peak performance? And really, at what point, if he's not going to do that at any point, you know, if they dig themselves into a deep enough hole to start the season, at what point is it not worth playing him in the games anymore? If he's not going to give peak performance and he's going to allow 8 goals each time, it doesn't, and not just for the team, you know, it's not just that it's not a good learning experience for the young D-Corps, but it's not good for him either.
Well, and I don't honestly believe he's the kind of person that would do that either. I just think, I don't know. Like I said, I'm making excuses because it just wasn't a fun game to watch. Let's move on to goal number 4.
I don't blame him for goal number 4. That was I believe that was Drew Doughty who kicked that one in.
I think it was Kovalchuk. It comes out of the okay. That's the one where it comes out of the corner and it just bounces off the guy's skate.
Yep.
Yeah, that was Kovalchuk, and again, that's one of those goals where it'll happen however many times in a season and you just
don't expect it to happen twice in the first 3 games.
No.
No. Which is part of the problem.
And listen, you know, again, maybe peak Jonathan Quick in the playoffs, you know, with his Jedi powers at optimum power. Maybe he stops that, but I'm not going to worry about it. Now, goal number 5 didn't bounce off of anybody. And this is, if I'm not mistaken, this is where we get, I guess I have the...
This is when he kind of tries to be old Jonathan Quick, and it also doesn't work.
Yeah, I thought these 2 goals were a lot closer to each other time-wise, but let's talk about goal number 5, Tanev's tap-in.
That one's kind of, once again, I feel like the caveat to all of these goals is Tanev, James Neal, you know, whoever it is, should not have been allowed to be there in the first place.
Yeah.
But Jonathan Quick isn't on angle. He isn't even there to stop the initial shot. You know, he's not there to stop that pass from, is that Connor McDavid who passed it? I didn't write
it's
that part down.
It's actually Quinn Hughes.
Quinn Hughes. Oh, that's right.
We moved on to
Vancouver. Yeah, that one, I mean, Jonathan Quick comes out. He's challenging. He's continuing to come out and slide, which was a habitual thing for Jonathan Quick in years past. We've seen him overslide in the past, but he's managed to get back. He's somebody who has fantastic edge work, and he's fantastic at redirecting himself back the other way. And he didn't. He just kind of kept sliding out, and he kind of turned and looked back at Tanev, who was standing basically on the goal line, tapping it in, like, ah, oh, there you are. It looked a little bit like apathy at that point. like you said, one of those things where it looked like he wasn't going to make a Stanley Cup final stop when the game was already where it was, which...
Well, a lot maybe, of this, I mean...
Maybe he was frustrated. Maybe it was a message. He might be sending a message to his defense that I'm not going to break myself to get guys that you shouldn't be allowing this close to me anyway.
Right.
In which case, I kind of support him on that. but it's not that it's horrendous goaltending. It's just not quality goaltending either. It's league average goaltending behind a very bad team.
Well, you said to me a few years ago that you believed that Quick's style, I'm paraphrasing, so correct me if I have what you said slightly wrong, but you said that Quick's style relied heavily on his reflexes and his athleticism, and that the coaching staff had tailored the team's defense around his strengths.
Correct.
The current coaching staff is clearly implementing new offensive and defensive systems, not tailored around Jonathan Quick's strengths. Is it possible that we're just seeing growing pains where, like you said, a lot of these goals may be, you know, maybe a goalie at, you know, an elite goalie at the top of his powers stops, but a lot of these situations are situations that never should arise in the first place?
I think that's, I definitely think that's part of it. No. I wasn't sure what you do. And I'd say probably 5 or 6 people said, well, you can't blame all of this on Jonathan Quick. This isn't his fault. He's got a bad defense in front of him. And he does. He has a horrendous defense in front of him. I don't think I've seen a defense that bad probably since the last Taylor Hall year. With the Oilers, maybe the year before they got Connor McDavid.
You know, you're hurting my feelings now, right?
You saw the team last night, right?
Yes, I did.
And while that's the case, we are not seeing the same decline in performance from Jack Campbell. So it's not entirely the defense's fault.
I mean, I'm not trying to slander Jack Campbell or anything, but he did. They gave up a 3-0. Anyway, we don't have to get into that. Let's really quickly.
He allowed 3 goals, which is
no,
not
I know.
Three.
It's not 8, though.
It's not 8, and it's no. not 6.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Let's quickly pound through these last 3. Alex Edler's goal. JT Miller. Sends a feed to Alexander Edler, who, you know, he just. I mean, look, he's
wide
again.
Break shot from the point.
Yeah.
I don't know if you didn't get that one.
I mean, that's one of those tough ones for me because, you know, he's allowed to walk in and take a completely uncontested wind-up running shot. And yet, if the shoe were on the other foot and we're watching the Kings score that goal, I don't know that we're criticizing the other goalie. That doesn't mean that the goalie doesn't deserve criticism. It's just, you know, he saw it all the way, right? There was nobody screening him. It wasn't,
right.
It didn't get deflected or anything. Yes, he could have stopped it, but anyway, things are not great. next one. I never know how to pronounce Levo's name. Josh Levo? Levo?
One of those.
But this is another tip in. Do we really blame him on an uncontested pass from the wall to his opposite side, and the guy just pops it over his pad?
I think we have to blame him for either the 6th goal or the 7th goal, because one of them is, you know, uncontested. He's able to track it all the way in theory. I guess he didn't. And he gets beat cleanly. The other one, there's a lot of cross ice movement. So at some point you have to expect him to be stronger at one of the two.
Sure.
Either he's stronger at being technically sound right now, or he's stronger at being overly reactive and athletic and getting those extra reaches. And right now he's kind of doing neither. And I think that those two goals right next to each other are kind of the perfect example of why it's not all on Quick, but it's also not all on the defense, because you have to be one or the other in the NHL. You have to be technically sound and get that Edler goal, or you have to be fantastic at recovering and reacting and get the Levo goal.
Now, in his defense, I will say at this point it was 6-2.
And he may have just wanted to see how high they could rack the score up. That's possible.
Well, I just mean it's 6-2. You know, there's 10 minutes left. They've just scored, you know, a minute and a half prior. I just wouldn't blame any human being, again, for subconsciously, not consciously, but just subconsciously not killing themselves to make that stop. And then the 8th goal, I don't, like, whatever. That was just no, you know, they didn't even announce it was a goal until, 45 seconds or however long after the puck actually crossed the line. And I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to blame anybody on that one. That's just one of those things.
Which one? The last one?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the last one I have. I mean, his own teammate took him out there.
Yeah, so.
That one's, I mean, if he had managed to stop that one, I would assume somebody had shoved a horseshoe all the way up his butt.
And there's,
that'd be luck.
There's one goal. I meant to mention it as we were watching it, but I missed it. So now I'm sort of going through trying to find it. But there was one goal. I believe it's – okay, so Miller's is the one that bounces off of Kovalchuk's foot. Maybe it's the fifth goal. Let me look real quick. But there's one goal where the face-off happens and then somebody immediately goes for a line change on the Kings as Vancouver is sort of steaming into the zone. And I remember, well, yeah, it's Edler's. It's the one-timer. It's the uncontested one-timer. And if you watch it, the face-off, I think, happens in, or maybe it's not a face-off, but the play starts in the Kings zone. And you can see, I believe it's Kovalchuk, just instantly, as Vancouver's steaming into the zone, Kovalchuk just goes for the line change. And then his man is Grunstrom, who comes back on for him. He's the one who's sort of half-heartedly trying to get in the way of that uncontested slap shot from Edler. And so that's one of those ones where you go like, okay, it was uncontested, quick saw it all the way, perhaps he could have stopped it, but why are we going for a line change on an odd man rush into the zone with the score at that point? And then the guy that's changing for you winds up being the man who's trying to cover the eventual goal scorer. It's not a great look.
it's kind of like a perfect storm. It's one of those things where I think just based on what we're seeing through these first two games of Jonathan Quick, he is either no longer caring, which nobody would blame him.
Well, but we're also not going to say that.
He's hurt, or he has regressed, and he is no longer, even if we're going to be, stingy with what we call him, he has been an above average NHL goalie his entire career. Even if we don't use the word elite, he's been above average. And that's, I think, something that nobody, including myself, has really contested. But he no longer looks like an above average goalie. And whether it's from age decline, from injury, or from apathy, he's just not making the stops that you have to make behind a rebuilding team.
Well,
and
first of all, we don't use that word.
Are we not calling this a rebuilding team? What are we calling it?
A reboot, a recreation, a retooling.
A resurrection.
A reimagining. Anything that starts with re. Just not that one.
Just not build.
Now, as a Kings fan and full disclosure employee, it's particularly confusing because a lot of us thought that he looked great in the preseason. And so these first two games, yes, the defense has been bad. And yes, there have been a lot of, two goals off of teammates' feet. And one scramble and et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I hope it's just a weird flu that they're not talking about. Because I thought he really did look strong in the preseason. And, yeah, the quality of competition was low. And, not every team is trying. And you're, dealing with teams made up of minor leaguers and stuff like that. But I appreciate your insight. And I appreciate your time. And I hope you're wrong.
I hope I am too. It's one of those things, like I said, whether you want to call Jonathan Quick elite or not.
And we do.
And you do. I maybe don't. But he was still an above average and consistently above average. That's really the big thing, is consistently he was above average for really the entirety of his career. And starting last year, things have not necessarily gone his way. And they have gone Jack Campbell's way enough since the beginning of last year that you can't pin the entire decline on the defense.
Yeah.
Because they're playing behind the same team. And they're playing behind a team that is performing the same way for both of them. So at some point, you just want to see something addressed that will help him get his game back, because it's not fun watching. That's really the bottom line. It's not fun for fans watching him give up 8 goals, and it's not fun even for the opponent, really, to watch a goaltender struggle, because you're not watching a quality, you know, oh, that was almost the perfect save, and oh, the puck slipped right past. You know, you're not getting to watch that. You're being robbed of really a high quality game on both sides, and you're being robbed of seeing a goaltender enjoy what he does. And it looks kind of like Jonathan Quick is not enjoying what he does right now. And you just want to see, whether you're a Kings fan or not, you want to see him at least finish out happy with what he's done. And I think he's happy with what he's done up to this point, but I don't think this is a fun way for his twilight years to go. And so I kind of want to see things bounce the other way for him. I just don't know if continuing to play him without making any changes is going to do that.
Well, you just spoke for every Kings fan. We all want him to be happy at what he's doing, and we want more entertaining outings than that. Kat, I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And good luck out there in Arizona. We'll be seeing you guys real soon.
Oh, yeah. See you guys soon.
All right. Thanks, Kat. That was Kat Silverman. Big thanks to her, Scott Wheeler, and, of course, Rasmus Kupari. We're still working out the kinks in the Matt Murray podcast studio in sunny El Segundo, so bear with us. We'll be bringing you more All the Kings Men, more Fox and Faust, more John Rosen, just more LA Kings talk in general as the season rolls on. So thanks for listening, Kings fans. We'll talk to you soon.